Rory McGowan. Now, you've kind of been a little bit sort of erratic in terms of attending the Midweek Drive Morning Edition over the last few months due to a variety of reasons, which we won't go into here. But what happens at this particular point of the programme after the news from the Sky News Centre?
Well, I think it's time for Gabriella Peralta in Gibraltar and her fabulous weather-telling skills.
He remembered, Gabriella. He remembered.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so the weather for Lincoln today is highs of 9 degrees centigrade, lows of 1 degree centigrade, and it's a day of light rain with a moderate breeze.
Oh. You have had a major article in the Gibraltar Chronicle, and as one of their key reporters, why wouldn't you, all relating to the Nazis, art treasures and more. Would you like to share some details with both Emily, Rory and the listener?
Yeah, so basically during the Second World War, we'll start at the beginning. I don't know if many of you know here, but
there was a Second
Hitler
World War.
Was,
I know.
Well,
shocker.
Hitler was a failed artist who had applied to the Vienna.
If only they'd given him an acceptance, you know, the whole taste of
the
world
whole
history.
Second World
exactly.
War would have changed. Precise. There wouldn't have been a Second
no,
World War
exactly.
if he got into art school.
Yeah.
But they said he was much better suited for architecture, but he had to study for that, and he wanted to do art. So he failed twice, and that's really where his anti-Semitism began, apparently. It was watching people in the board that were Jewish, seeing the art dealers. So then when he did take over as Führer, and started the Second World War, he kept his penchant for art. So every time they took over a place, every stronghold, they would steal all the art from it.
I mean, if you're going to actually effectively look for Lebensraum, annex Austria, annex Czechoslovakia, get the Danzig corridor from Poland, thereby triggering the events that launched the Second World War, why wouldn't you collect some arty things on the way? I mean, it's a way for. I mean, Richard Fitzwilliams does his art tours. I don't think he's quite the same league as Hitler, but, you know, I'll just sort of work our way through that. Yeah.
I hope he's not.
I think he'll be. That's a big compliment to say he's not in the same league as Hitler.
Yeah, I'd like to say that.
So,
yeah.
There we go.
I might refer to it. He probably won't be listening now, but he will be in a few minutes. Anyway, carry on.
But it was really, really, a really, really interesting talk that was held in Gibraltar. It was just this woman, her great-great-aunt actually had her art stolen. So she had an art dealership in Austria in the 1930s, and then it was taken over by the Nazis. And after they took over her art dealership, they met her in her apartment, and she had this painting on the wall, and it was from her personal collection. And they wanted that too. So what oftentimes they did was they would buy things well below market value, so at least they would have in their books, because they kept records of everything, they would have in their books that it was sold. But really what it was sold under duress and intimidation. So she gave them her painting and she fled the country the next day. And then once the Second World War ended, she kept on fighting to get her painting back, and she never did during life, but her family continued after her death. And it wasn't until, so the art collector died, it went to the Austrian government, and then the Austrian government loaned it out to the MoMA Museum in New York that they could...
which is technically the Museum of Modern Art, just in case you're still saying MoMA. What's that? Museum of Modern Art, exactly.
So it was loaned out to New York, and that was finally their chance because they got it out of Austria. So what they could do was they wrote to the museum. They did an interview with the New York Times that went very big. This was back in the 1990s. And in the end, it started off this whole legal battle where they essentially sued a country's government from another country, it being America. So they sued the Austrian government from America. It ended up being a 12-year legal battle, and they settled for 19 million. So the painting went up in worth quite a lot over those years. And the deal was it would be returned to the Austrian government, because who can keep a $19 million painting in their house, let alone the insurance? So it was taken back to, given back to the Austrian government, but the deal was that there would be a message beside it in the museum saying about the aunt's story. So it was a happy ending in the end, because at least the aunt has her story now in the Leopold Museum, I think it is, in Austria. So if you ever go to Austria and you go to that museum, it's there, her aunt's story. I think her name was Leah Bondi-Jurai, if I'm pronouncing that all correct. And you can go see a portrait of Wally.
That's what we need to know. Yeah. In fact, the classic
They hid art all over. Every time Hitler's army was getting close to any museums, the museums would have to evacuate all their paintings and everything because they were too scared of Hitler stealing it. So, and his plan was he was going to sell the art he didn't like, which he did. He sold the art he didn't like, any modern art he hated, and he sold that to
it was bourgeois and trash.
And
bourgeois
the art trash. He liked, the art he liked
went up to the Burgersgarten and various other parts of places.
For his Führer Museum in Lindt. So, had he had his way, apparently Paris would pale in comparison to his Führer Museum.
Of course. Exactly, because it was all designed for that just as well. He didn't really, at least in our dimension, still, never mind. There is obviously linking a connection between Wally and finding where he is, but I won't go there because it would be ridiculous. And somewhat crass, to be honest.
It was, where's Wally?
Yeah, exactly. Emily, you're shaking your head there because clearly £19 million.
I was about to say, I think I'm just in amazement. I mean, I never knew that story, but like you said, it could have changed absolutely everything if that was the case.
Yeah.
And Rory?
Happiness we need for this Thursday morning, I believe. That was beautiful, Gabriella. I don't really have a lot to say.
Exactly. I mean, I was going to talk about
it. I loved that story, and it was so interesting speaking to the woman and the story about her aunt.
Or, technically in German, her tant. Actually, she wasn't German, so forget that. It's just really
no,
from
that point. She was
from Austria. Well, actually, Austrian with Tante as well.
They do speak German.
Tante. Mm. Well, that's suppose Hitler, in fact, was Austrian. Sorry, Austrian people, but that's the bottom line, actually. Anyway, so it goes. Gabriella, who would you like to ask you the last two questions? Would it be Rory or would it be Emily?
Rory asked me the weather, so I'll go with Emily to make it fair.
Gabriella, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning?
I have, thank you.
And will you be joining us soon?
Yes, I will. Next week.
Exactly. Gabriella Peralta, we salute you. Take care. Out there, Rory, out there, if you can see it, is the perfect lap the perfect lap. You have no messing about, you just can see it, you can see the perfect lap, and that is what we'll be looking for with the perfect cinema review. And one day, he'll probably achieve it. Who knows, will it be today? We don't know. But if it's Ford versus Ferrari, if it's Le Mans 66, it can only be Richard Fitzwilliams on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. Isn't that right, Richard?
Well, I have to say it's a pleasure to talk about a film that I can't even drive, but it held me. I was very, very excited. It's a thrilling experience, you know.
Well, as I said, the only thing that would have made it absolutely perfect is if you'd swapped Christian Bale's role with Felicity Jones, because that would have actually made it much more sort of user-friendly and woke awareness and rewritten history in the same way, of course, as the Aeronauts was done. But maybe you might disagree on that one.
Well, I just might.
I thought you might, exactly. Okay, we'll go into Le Mans 66, a movie which I think is pretty, pretty impressive, and lots of zoom, zoom, zoom. I thought initially it was going to be a kind of remake of Steve McQueen's kind of...
No. I mean, it's true. I do remember Steve McQueen, and I mean, that was good fun. A lot of use of the split screen, I seem to recall. Mm. In McQueen, but here, I mean, it's a high-powered buddy movie, but director James Mangold really handles it with panache. It's the ferocious realism of the scenes of motor racing. I mean, normally it hasn't got a particular appeal to me. When I, you know, started watching, first he's got two perfect the matched performances, Christian Bale playing Ken Miles, former soldier, love of danger leads him to become uniquely talented and inventive racing driver, and he needs the money to support his wife, Molly, played by Catriona Bale, and his son Peter, played by Noah Jupe. But the trouble is, he isn't the most diplomatic of souls. Temper, poor judgment of the track, say, leads to all sorts of problems. It's quite interesting, it's very interesting. The Ford Motor Company turned to Carroll Shelby, entrepreneur, designer, and former racing driver, played by mate Matt Damon, when they have to beat Ferrari in the world's top endurance race, Le Mans, which lasts 24 hours for those who don't know, and Damon is perfectly cast too. And it's based on an incident when the Ford boss, Henry Ford II, played by Tracy Letts, I don't know the actor, but my God, he's good, approached Enzo Ferrari, played by Remo Gironi, to team up, but was rejected. And very, very unwisely, Ferrari added a personal insult to Ford, who put all his resources into building the perfect car. Carroll Shelby, the Matt Damon character, is the engineering genius they need. He has to have the right driver, and the film concentrates also on the hatred between Lea Cocker, played by John Bernthal, who is the pro-Miles, and Leo Beebe, played by Josh Lucas, the vice president of Ford, who is against him. And so with all the squabbling between the executives, it could sink the whole thing. One of the interesting aspects of this movie is if you think you know what's going to happen, perhaps you might be right. I never give spoilers, but you also might be wrong.
Don't stop, Christian. Keep going. Don't stop. They'll cheat you. Sorry.
Well, I have to say that in one scene I've got to mention, Tracy Letts as Henry Ford II, one of these amazing egotistical characters, but there's one scene where he actually goes into his car for a test drive. It's his because he's had it built with Miles, and the mixture of terror when he breaks down at the speed, and it's wonderful. That's a pretty good imitation, actually. It is. And then also the mixture of pride at the achievement, because he's living in the shadow of his father, Henry Ford, and my goodness me, what would Daddy think if he could see him now? And the funny thing is, when Beebe is locked by Shelby in his office, that is very funny. So he has to watch helplessly as his boss takes a spin with Miles. That is extremely funny. And, I mean, you've got scenes like Shelby and Miles actually fighting in front of Miles' house, with Molly looking on in disdain. Women's roles in this movie, rather like The Irishman, I'm afraid they're not that well developed. But my goodness me, it's an edge of the seat, a thrilling docudrama and a fascinating study of a sport of those who find its dangers addictive. Wow, yes.
Well, thumbs up, but let's just test it with the dynamic duo who are in the studio at present. First of all, Rory, will you or have you already seen Le Mans?
I have not, but with a stellar cast like that, and I mean, it's a film about cars.
And the wrench is worth seeing, just for the wrench, really. The way the wrench flies through the air, it's very good, very impressive. Although, having said that, Henry Ford II's management style maybe leads to one or two things to be desired. It's not great for morale, perhaps. Just by the by.
But I do think it may well be that I do see this one, because I am interested in that kind of genre.
It needs to be seen on a big screen. I mean, I normally, as you're well aware, I say in most movies you can actually just watch on a mobile phone, but I think you need to see this on a big screen. Lawrence of Arabia, you need to see that on a mobile phone.
Alex, normally, I wouldn't interrupt. You know me.
Yeah,
I'm quiet and docile.
Yes.
But in fact, what you said is so outrageous for one reason, that I can actually quote what's just happened with the citizens of Netflix when they stream within a week or two. Mm-hmm. And that is that Marriage Story, which is an absolutely brilliant movie, we've discussed it before. I mean, to find it after its release last Friday, it's in a couple of cinemas, and I saw it in a tiny cinema to see it a second time last night. Because they know it's going on Netflix, people aren't bothering, and it ought to be seen not on your mobile, but on a large screen. But this is an interesting example, because I hadn't realized before, I didn't know the figures for The Irishman, but presumably 208 minutes of that. I mean, you can understand perhaps people either dying to see it or maybe waiting. But in this case, when you've got a 2-and-a-bit-hour film and a really good one, the cast, as I've told you, of, you know, we discussed it before, of Scarlett Johansson and Adam Driver, absolutely brilliant, good supporting cast too, about a coast-to-coast divorce and custody battle, and nobody is going to see it. It's hardly made anything.
Maybe because it's just dull and uninteresting and, you know, what the hey.
Which it isn't. You wait till the awards and I will make you eat those words.
Well, we'll hold on that. Meanwhile,
you can drop those words out of the balloon.
Well, Stephen Price has taken over from, of course, our Marco Beltrami soundtrack to Le Mans 66 with She's Late, which is where, of course, we see Felicity Jones' character of Amelia Wren being late for that 1862 pioneering adventure with meteorologist James Glasher, played by Eddie Redmayne, advancing human knowledge is the reason, advancing human knowledge of the weather and to fly higher than anyone in history. What a profound statement that actually is in so many ways, and how thrilling it is as the aeronauts actually advance through the ether. But I suspect, Richard, we have to, again, disagree in terms of your views vis-a-vis the aeronauts. Surely, well, the 19th century version of Le Mans 66.
Well, yes, after, you know, the sweet reasonableness, I'm afraid, and also your quip about iPhones, I mean, and watching movies on them, that's too much after last night. But actually, the aeronauts, I mean, I have been looking up reviews, and it did seem to do well, I have to say, to my surprise. It's directed, indeed, by Tom Harper, a top-rate cast. I absolutely agree with Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones, but 100 minutes that did not inspire me. In 1862, indeed, we had James Glaser, played by Eddie Redmayne, and the rich young widow Amelia Wren, played by Felicity Jones, mount a balloon expedition to fly high. It's actually, there were two men, Henry Glaser and pilot Henry James, but who worries about that?
It's the 2020s nearly. We need to actually sort of rewrite gender history. Come on now.
Absolutely. They rise above 10,000 onlookers, but in reality the balloon, when it came to excitement, what was going on in it, to me, firstly, it did look like a studio, the way they were walking up or, shall we say, climbing up and down the sides, and it seemed a little chilly from time to time, and all this. It has to go higher than anything ever has, and the weather is volatile. I mean, there were moments with butterflies appearing. I mean, some stunning visuals there. You were going to get that. You always would have. And wind and hailstones and altitude and sickness and all sorts of problems. The problem is, to me, it was very grounded because I thought what was going on in that balloon, call me wrong if you like, was in fact a film set, and of course it was, but it looked like it. And once unreality had taken hold on, yes, there were flashbacks to their lives on the ground and the fact that scientific establishment thought it was nonsense and so on, and how the journey began and all of this. I mean, it simply didn't grab me, unfortunately. I like both actors, but you know, the theory of everything was one thing. I mean, this is, well, was for me very much another. It isn't that, you know, I have an aversion to scientific movies or anything. It simply was that it remained grounded, and I got very, very bored, because if you don't believe what's going on in the balloon is, despite soaring clouds and all the rest of it, and undoubtedly tons of discomfort, the facts are it can get dull, and for me did.
Can't believe that anybody could say anything that Jeff Bezos's company, Amazon Prime, is responsible for could be dull and uninteresting. I just think that's astounding.
Well, I can only say that I'm deeply shocked that you should actually attribute such virtue to a company.
Everybody's happy to work with them. Have you not seen the commercials? I mean, everybody loves working. You can even have factory tours now to actually show how wonderful it actually is.
This is fate that has gone, that is blind.
Emily, I know you're very keen to defer your gratification and saving up all your movie-going stuff for one wonderful balance of Frozen 2. No sign of Kira. She's obviously been too overwhelmed with the release of Frozen 2. She's having to have a lie-down. But the Aeronauts, would you be finding it of any interest at all?
See, I hate to say it, but I think I'm actually the opposite. The prior film that we spoke about isn't something that I think would really interest me. Mm. Whereas Aeronauts, I have seen the advert for and seen the trailer for, and I think that is definitely something I would watch.
So no to the factually correct Le Mans, but yes to the factually incorrect and gender balanced
I hate
Aeronauts.
To say it, but yes.
Well, yes, I mean, it's not the factual aspect of it that I'm really concerned with, obviously. I mean, you have to have a certain basis for a story, what they do with it. I mean, any drama, I don't normally quibble when it comes to fact. It's a question of whether or not the essence, so to speak, of what has happened is conveyed. I mean, I haven't managed, for reasons you will all appreciate, to start The Crown, episode 3. Well, I mean, they've been nearly, it's nearly 50 now on you know what. So,
Indeed. And I mean, having just actually heard from Gabriella Peralta in Gibraltar, who actually was really referencing something which I know, another movie that Richard was a big fan of, The Monuments Men, all about Nazi art treasures being hunted down and released in all sorts of ways, etc. You know, clearly we're working through that process. You'd be pleased to know, Richard, if you didn't hear the early part of the programme, Rory did pick up on the fact that I did say that there was a complete difference in terms of appreciation of art between your tour of art galleries and Adolf Hitler's tour of art galleries in the Second World War. So,
that is very generous of you. The only appreciation I can show is to remind you, because I may have mentioned this a long time ago, that the Monuments Men is generally considered rather dull and unexciting. And
it's got George Clooney, though.
Failed. I know George Clooney failed. But what was interesting was, for some reason, they asked me to the press conference, and I'd seen in a tiny footnote somewhere that Clooney had spoken out about returning the Elgin Marbles to Greece. So when I asked my question, I knew precisely what to plant, and it had the effect of a certain mayor. His name escapes me in this election period.
Is he the one who tells lies quite frequently?
I don't know this. I'm just trying to remember. But a certain mayor of London was outraged at this, and so it led to a very, very entertaining boxing match. But I began it, and that was at the press.
And that's probably the reason he doesn't want to be interviewed by Andrew Neil these days, but that's by the by. Yeah?
I have to say that without going into politics, I don't think that... I mean, I think being interviewed by someone who has... You've got to have... I would say this, you've really, really, with John Humphreys gone, John Paxman, for all their faults, gone, you do need someone who's really got forensic interviewing
Sir
skills.
Sir Robin Day, gone a long time ago.
Oh, well, yes, I mean, you're really thinking back. I mean, Robin Day was the one, I think, who asked Margaret Thatcher the same question five times or something. I think the only time that was beaten was Jeremy Paxman asking Michael Howard something seven times, and this is all from memory. But you really do need a grand inquisitor, you really do need somebody that's incisive when it comes to answering questions as opposed to escaping them. I mean, we've still got the third, well, the next interview by Andrew Deal coming with Johnson, but I mean, it really will be fascinating because you can't.
Although,
there's no escape.
Yeah, rumours are that he's actually going to step aside from that, basically. But there we are.
No, you can't step aside from it. I don't think it's possible. I think if you've agreed to do it, I think it's part and parcel of part and parcel, shall we say, the course for what's happening. I didn't see the one with Joe Swinton. But because it really has been very, very difficult to keep track of the political and then deal with...
the day-to-day experience of cultural arts in the world today.
Well, the day-to-day experience of Prince Andrew in the world today.
Let's just step away. Let's please have a PA-free zone from that point of view.
I agree.
I mean, he has actually done more to actually abolish the monarchy than anybody's this side of Cromwell, really, which is wonderful in its own way if he's gone down that line. But, you know, other than that, the Republican cause could actually be cheering around the globe, basically saying, well, only a matter of months now before we actually put it into practice. Let's move to Rory McGowan.
I don't think that it will affect people's view as to what, with all the politicians squabbling and the Brexit problems, and I mean, without going into that, I don't think it will mean that people would want a republic. But I do think, the idea, by the way, of a slimmed down monarchy is a silly phrase, simply because if people want them to do 3,000 engagements, mostly are carried out with aplomb. The only time you hear about it is when something goes wrong. If they want that, and charities and the links with regiments and institutions, all of these, it has a certain cachet, you can't have too slimmed down a monarchy, because the Duke of Edinburgh, after all, is attached still to... If it was 837, it's down to 780. You need to know that. The point is that all of those institutions are having other royals step in now to do them. Now, when you've got Andrew's 200...
Can we not borrow someone from, maybe, I don't know, one of the Malaysian royal family to kind of step in, etc., and do some sort of...
Now, that is a very, very interesting idea. And I suspect, in a previous incarnation, Alex, you would have enjoyed being a member of the Malaysian royal family. I mean, can I just ask a straight...
Apparently, according to my sort of detailed analysis of lives I've actually lived in previous centuries, my last incarnation of the planet was in the 11th century as a Ukrainian. I don't know.
That's interesting. But here's a question for you. If you go and you're a Malaysian sultan and you've taken your turn as head of state, you go on a golf course, you know, you'd expect to do well, wouldn't you?
Of course.
I mean, you've got a caddy with you.
Yeah, absolutely, at least one. But,
I mean, you take your swing and it goes wrong and he laughs at you.
You shoot the caddy. There's no mystery about it. Quite right. Clearly, you know. I wasn't saying with a bullet. I could say possibly an arrow, but, you know, you'd effectively execute him in some way, shape, or form. You know.
I must tell listeners that happened. Yeah. In fact, there was a polo match, too, where there was another problem, certain ambiguities of behaviour.
And wouldn't Prince Andrew's interview gone a lot better if halfway through he could have actually said, I'm sorry, I don't like this question, you're dead.
Now, that's a question that hasn't come up in the papers. No. So I think we better not go in there.
I don't think so, yeah, exactly, because after all, there's only so much you can actually take, as we said.
But this is the interesting point, and that is an interesting point, about being only so much that can be taken and remembered. That went so badly wrong, and there were so many things wrong with it, that it's quite, that, you know, if you had to list them, so that you didn't, I've had to list them so that I haven't forgotten any, because, I mean, there's so many, I mean, normally you just simply don't get time to discuss most of them. It was such a dreadful mess.
It was a masterclass in ineptitude from the public relations side.
So yes, but not only that, I would remind you that he's had to dismiss his private secretary, who arranged it, Amanda Thirsk, and he's just appointed her as the chief executive officer of Pitchat Palace, which apparently he's just hanging on to, according to reports. That means she knows where the bodies are buried, because, or some such, because, I mean, it just makes no sense. It's an insane thing to do. I mean,
maybe it's a different version of the word pitch. Maybe it's pitch as in kind of tarmac, so you actually bury it under the pitch.
Now that's starting to make sense to me. Maybe it is. But also, 2%, remember the cut that he could take on any deals from that? I mean, the whole thing has unravelled, and it's unravelled during the general election campaign. And interestingly enough, it was Robert Hardwin, the Daily Mail, who pointed out that the last time, because the Queen will undoubtedly apologise for the fact that the royal family have detracted from the campaign itself, the last time this happened was in 1992, and those involved were a certain Duke and Duchess of York.
Yeah, bless them. But that's toe-sucking for you. You know, let's just not go there, because at the end of the day, we don't want to... I mean, all you need is a palace, a royal palace, to actually burn now, and it's another Annus Horribilis, but still, let's move on.
It's not another Annus Horribilis, because when the Prince and Princess of Wales are affected, when Windsor actually starts to burn, when you appear to be forced to pay tax, when in fact it has been in the pipeline, but I mean, everything went wrong in that year. And the monarchy survived. I mean, the point is not the survival of the monarchy. The point is what sort of monarchy people want, and also how those who are part of it have, in the case of Andrew and, well, I mean, Sarah, who's, if the Duke of Edinburgh hadn't been around, who knows, they might have tried to remarry it, certainly, but now, thank goodness. But then you've got, and here's another point, a perfectly serious point. Beatrice is marrying next year, and if they only had a tiny church in Italy or crappy church in Scotland, that'd be fine. The test of what's been learnt is what they decide to do, because you can't. I mean, it'd be absolutely
impossible.
Remember,
Richard, failure is not falling down. Failure is staying down.
Who said that?
I just have. Moving on to Rory McGowan. Will you be seeing the Aeronauts, or is it a case of, no, I'll just stick with Le Mans 66?
I am very interested in the Aeronauts. I was planning to ask Richard about Eddie Redmayne, but we seem to have gone on a tangent.
We have.
I didn't feel either performer were able to show their acting skills because the format of the movie meant they were confined in balloons, and I mean, there's a problem, so she's got to
a balloon,
climb up.
Richard, a balloon, not balloons, just a single balloon.
Well,
single
all right, that's a single balloon. I wasn't suggesting that somehow it had metamorphosed into several in front of my rather tired eyes whilst watching it. The problem
her little hands as she's crawling up the side of the balloon to actually release the air valve, you know?
Whatever the air valve was, it, yes. But the point is, sometimes movies just don't inspire you, and sometimes movies just don't interest you. And that one seemed trapped.
Richard, don't worry, you got Charlie's Angels to look forward to, so good stuff as far as that's
concerned. But if you've got something like Le Mans 66, I mean, there you, or Ford versus Ferrari, there you've got a really, really good movie. And also, when you've got Marriage Story, you've got a brilliant one. Be warned about making jokes about Netflix, because I've just given you an example of what happens to a film and on the wide screen it's killed.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes if the time has reached where an art form has to change or evolve, maybe that's the whole case, basically.
Oh, no, this is the case. This is the battle. This is the debate. And the French are holding out for 3 years, and Hollywood's still holding out for 6 weeks. There are exceptions, and we do all sorts of different things on this.
Rory, last two questions for Richard, please.
Okay, so Richard, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
Well, yes, I mean, it's been weighing delight and dole, hasn't it? Because Le Mans 66 is really terrific, and I totally agree with Alex there. The Aeronauts we've had some fun with, and I'm sure, like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and other such movies.
Oh, classics, exactly.
classic exactly. Indeed. Hugh Grant.
Guy Ritchie's Man from U.N.C.L.E. And Hugh Grant was indeed good in The Man
from U.N.C.L.E.
Alexander Waverley.
He was.
He encapsulated the whole Leo G. Carroll incarnation of the original series, I felt.
God gracious me, you intellectualize.
It's important. Next question.
And will you be back with two more movies again next week?
You bet I will be, and let's just hope it's only movies. Remember that on the second Panorama, Virginia Roberts Giuffre will be giving her side in an interview, apparently, that was... an issue that was taped before the Andrew catastrophe, but that is going to stir things up again.
It's highly challenging. Meanwhile, Tessa Snart's track of the week, as delivered yesterday on the Midweek Drive by a German, Sina Thiel and Sabrina Fallon, is this.
Drinking wine, but I've missed this land of mine. Good to be back home. Good to be back home. I've been traveling.
Edgy country rock meets a hearty blend of traditional and today, the results can only be a catchy, upbeat dance tune with a great Irish feel. Interesting, last night, Emily was very much into a toe-tappy routine. This morning, not so much, basically, it's more a case of,
Does it float your boat still, Emily?
See, I think last night I really liked it.
No.
I still like it, but maybe not as much.
Is it because lead singer's German?
No.
That's all right, I just wanted to make that clear. Because you never know in these days, in terms of there might be a little bit of, you know, because of what happened in the war and everything else, and not so routines. Sina Tyle, of course, the hottest act in Irish country music, although she's German, with award-winning entertainer Sabrina Fallon, and Good to Be Back Home, something which I know you echo on a regular basis every time you go home, which is where we're speaking to you now, isn't that right, Ian Lennox? It's Good to Be Back Home.
All Geordies are the same.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as we get across that Tyne Bridge, our little eyes light up.
Even if they're in Australia, they've mistaken the Tyne Bridge for the Sydney-Australia Bridge, just as a matter of course, because it's very confusing.
They're very similar, aren't they?
So similar, bigger. Yeah. Built using the same iron and steel that was used for the Newport Bridge in Middlesbrough, of course. So there we are. That's a little fact from that point of view. And Middlesbrough, of course, got a win, a much-needed win against Barnsley last night. 1-0, one English goal to nil with Fletcher scoring, which just lifts Middlesbrough slightly out of the relegation zone in the Championship. Sunderland, of course, nicely defeated by Burton, so still well ensconced in mid-table mediocrity in Division 1. And, of course, a fine game which will even get Ian a chance to put down his pots and pans occurring on Saturday, when not only is there an open day at the University of Lincoln, but it is 12:30, the game where indeed it's your lads, Steve Bruce's boys, versus Pep's Perfections, basically.
Well, you never know what happened last season. Huh?
Yeah, I know, exactly. It's just, you know, these are the kind of things we need to address. And
no, that's not the answer. The answer is we lost 2-1. That's what you should be saying.
No. I mean, I'm just
saying. After we gave you a goal to start as well.
Yeah, these are the challenges. Sergio won't be fit. He's out. He won't even be around for the Manchester
derby. Yeah, no. Yeah, but you've got such a fantastic squad, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but you know, we're suffering. We're stretched thin these days, you know. I mean, Gabriel Jesus is having to sort of work through the process. I don't know. Emily's eyes are glazing over because obviously we're talking football, and being in Essex last, I mean, did football actually enter into the argument as a case? I suppose. Yeah.
I'm going to be honest, I'm not really a football fan.
No. usually in Essex, this could be a gross stereotype, I'll just preface prefix that line.
Yeah.
Wives and girlfriends, Essex, etc. There's a lot of connections there, but obviously you're not following that. That
people have had their microphones turned up less, haven't they?
They have indeed. Absolutely. And I'm not going to talk about Ian Wright and his potential bullying behaviour, which he's being accused of in that Jungle programme, but still.
Really?
Yeah, you know, it's well.
I don't follow these things any longer.
Really? Are you more of a strictly person? Do you follow all of those sort of things?
I don't follow this celebrity caper thing where somebody famous has a hiccup and the world stops.
Yeah, well, you know, if it's the Duke of York, maybe that will be the case, but still.
No.
But we won't go there. We've already talked
about
it.
No, you better not.
exhausted the whole thing we are. Jonathan Miller, Gary Rhodes, and Clive James, of course, are both headed off this mortal coil yesterday. Any thoughts you'd like to share? Because I suspect you might have messed up with Clive James in your media work.
No, I never did, but I thought he was incredible. Jonathan Miller was a brilliant man.
Mm-hmm.
I saw him a number of times. I saw him from the 60s onwards. And funny enough, as a young man, I visited the Establishment Club in London, which is where one of his early
haunts. And in addition to that, he was one of the footlights from Cambridge, because he was very much associated with the Pythons and Monty Python and various other things.
Strange, though, they all seem to meet together. There's this congress of this incredible talent, these young people, and suddenly
they're... Like Midwick Drive-Ats?
And the goons were the same. They all got together somehow.
Well, that's a key thing. And in addition to that, of course, we've got the line that Jonathan Miller once said, that people don't fall ill, they choose to fall ill. Because it's all part and parcel of the whole thing. That's the whole thing. Which I always thought at the time was
quite
harsh.
Yeah, the doctor as well, of course, isn't
it? Yeah, exactly. Very, very, very. The Body in Question. Fantastic series. Well worth accessing. Back in the day. I'm sure available on various sort of platforms as well. Kind of equivalent to Carl Sagan's Cosmos. I'm yattering on here.
Apparently, it's one of those people you would hardly ever find anybody who could say a bad word about him. He was never a trivial man. He always liked serious conversations.
And
he was a very kind and considerate person.
He liked to obviously direct his operas as well. That was important.
Yes, brilliant. He's just brilliant at everything he did.
A polymath.
That's right. I was searching for that word at the back of my little
head. I knew you were. That's why I sort of...
Thank you very much.
I went there and I sort of took it out.
Sure.
Two for fine folk in the studio. Rory McGowan. You know Rory from Bedfordshire. Every so often goes down with food poisoning. Great lad. Basically does creative writing and journalism.
Has food poisoning in Bedfordshire got some link?
He will insist on actually trying all these culinary dishes like Japanese blowfish on a regular basis. So don't do it. You don't want to go down that line. Seriously. Stick to beans on toast. That's the student perspective.
Scrambled egg.
Exactly. Scrambled egg, beans and toast. I mean, it's
a
like...
a bit of porridge.
Marvellous. Take that, Europeans. Apart from Scots, obviously. And Emily Bolton Boston, who I will obviously sort of put that, I will insist on putting in that consonant. It is, of course, Emily Boston, not Bolton, who's also engaging in her fourth show, I think.
Yes, yeah, my fourth show now.
Fourth show.
Four on out, eh?
Yeah, exactly. Consecutively,
every
of course.
Boycott.
Midweek drive evening, midweek drive morning, midweek drive evening, midweek drive morning. It's like a metronome so far, you know, just there. It's that sort of thing. So, you know, I appreciate a final year student reading English, of course, but keen, Ian, to work in the magical world of radio.
Oh, really? Oh, good.
Yeah, something to do with media, I think, definitely BBC or something around there, so. Oh.
And what year is your course in now?
Third year, so I'm in my final year now.
Oh, right. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So it's getting hard then.
Yes, it's stressful to say the least. I'd definitely say that.
Yeah. Have you done any stuff outside? In radio outside the university?
No, this is the first radio I've done, but I've got some stuff hopefully lined up in the works for some kind of production management. So fingers crossed that goes to plan.
Right.
That's
well, good luck.
Thank you.
It's a hard thing to get into, but I shall tell you much more. You know, as much more about that.
No, you just basically stagger in sometimes, actually press a few buttons, and that's it. I mean, yeah, it's money for old. You take your Greg James, you basically sort of, you know, he decides, oh, what the hey, I'll just become a radio presenter, and then he works on that basis.
I'm one of those people who can't stagger in, press buttons, and talk at the same time.
Really? Oh, yeah. That's not what I've heard, you know. I mean, every time you were sort of going into those interviews, etc., I thought you were all sorted through on that system.
Oh, I can do that.
Yeah, exactly.
That's technical side, I suppose. My second eldest daughter is brilliant at technical things. She used to work in television. She was a very good camera operator. She was very good on sound. She could do lighting. And she could do interviews as well. So I could do interviews,
that was it. Yeah, but you're male, we can't multitask. I mean, it's understandable, you know. Females can actually multitask as males. We can only focus, it's hunter-gatherer. Tunnel vision, go,
true,
see,
yes.
Get. That's what it's all about. Yes. A third of British people, as we said yesterday, feel trapped, Ian, on Christmas. Mm-hmm. Because Christmas is the most stressful time of the year.
It is, it's more rows and things than any time. At Christmas time, any other time of the year.
According to 2,000 British folks surveyed, the December festive season is more stressful than birthdays and Halloween. A third of those surveys say they feel trapped when spending the festive season as a guest in someone's house. Well, they could literally be actually.
Oh, yes.
As a guest.
Well, I've got a lodger coming in, he's filming over Christmas.
Are you going to lock the doors and make sure he doesn't escape?
Not until he's paid rent, yes.
And basically, if you can actually address it by saying something like, hello. Good evening. And kind of have a sort of quivering smile that kind of isn't quite a smile, is more kind of, you know...
The bars on this window come down once you've paid the rent.
Yeah, exactly.
Welcome.
See, that's what we call the bonhomie of the Geordie, okay? La bonhomie de Geordie. That's coming across there. Apparently, in the United Kingdom, as we revealed yesterday, we'll talk about with comedian Hal Cruttendon in a few moments, the most stressful cities, Ian, in ascending order from 3-2-1, are Oxford, London and Sheffield at number one. If you're in Sheffield, that is the number one spot for actually getting stressed at Christmas.
Why Sheffield?
I have no idea.
And how do they decide these things?
On the grounds of presumably findings from this, I mean, the same way they decided the election, and we already know that basically that we're going to have a thing sorted out with 2 weeks to go, basically. That's all been decided. The most laid back at Christmas, you might like this, Ian. Number one, Bristol. Number two, York. But in third place, for most laid back at Christmas time, Newcastle.
Well, they're all drunk. Literally laid back.
You may say that, Ian, but honestly.
You can hardly move with the sound of people snoring.
It's going to be fun for his lodger. That's all I can say. is your lodger from the region?
If you end up watching Cassie and I play every second week, Alex, you'll be laid back. We're laid out.
I sense the pain, really. I do sense the pain. Yeah. Don't worry, it'll pan out. What do you have in store for yourself today? Is it more writing? Have you disciplined yourself to actually get more writing done?
I've taken a break this week because since last February, I've written over 100,000 words. And I'm getting old now. And
I mean, that's a PhD, basically.
Pretty well exhausted me, actually. So
yeah, but 100,000 words is not bad. I mean, that's like 10 undergraduate dissertations or one PhD. You know, so either way, you're doing well on that basis. Can we not get you an honorary doctorate somewhere? Can we not have a word with the University of Sunderland and say, hi, pets, fling us one of those PhDs up here like man, honey, you know?
And I'd love to work well. On the university. I've enjoyed it.
I mean, Dr. Lennox comes to town. You know, that'd be great.
I come from a family of medical people. And I'm the worst writer of the lot of them.
Yeah, but thankfully you don't.
My writing rather is the worst.
You don't do surgery. That's the important thing.
Cool.
Because otherwise, you know.
I made the lodger more scared. I do surgery.
My family are all doctors, but I never quite made the grade. Can I practice on you?
Pays the rent.
This is the kind of thing that happens.
He's been before, he's a good lad.
Well, that's all right then. You know, much better to have a good lad than a psychotic killer if you're having a lodger. It's just a little point for the day in many ways. Okay, it's coming round to 9:07 in terms of time checks. In the second hour of the programme, as we mentioned, Hal Cruttendon will be talking about festive stress. Mike Berners-Lee will be talking about how don't send those emails. You need to care for the environment more. William Sitwell will hopefully be joining us, and we've got a cyber security special as well with Royal Holloway London and discussions about how... Actually, if you're thinking of jobs to do, forget your media. You want to go into real jobs? Become Emily, a cybersecurity specialist. Average salary, £72,500 per annum. Okay?
Jeez. We're in the wrong field.
Retrain. Yeah. I specifically talk about journalism students.
What does that involve, though?
Just basically cybersecurity. That's it, effectively. And that's the basic starting thing from that point of view. So there we are. You'll hear more about that in the second part of the program.
A few buttons to press there.
Yeah, but as long as you press them in the right way, that's the important thing. Not that one! Sorry, that's just... so often, that's it. No! Just sorry.
Just sometimes, wiped out the White House's memory bank. Oh, good.
Exactly. Now, I could have talked about your Noam Chomsky connections. I could have talked about your comment with respect to the wonderment of it, Fiona Hill. And I could have also shared the line that you said about Ian Lennox. Not Ian Lennox, about Donald Trump in the White House. But I figured, no, you know, enough of that, basically. I mean, Rory might disagree profoundly with that whole system. But, you know, at least he maintains what the truth is. Variable concept, perhaps. Never mind.
You do know Fiona Hill came from up here, don't you?
Well... I mean,
well, you do now because of
because of your erudite Facebook system, etc. And when you say up here, you're talking about Newcastle, obviously.
Yes, sorry, I'm subjective.
Because sometimes people sort of wonder. I mean, up here could mean simply up the hill if you're in Lincoln. You know, it could literally mean just somewhere at the top of the
hill. Well, if you're at the top of the hill, you shout up here, it's for the wood.
Yeah, exactly.
That wouldn't really work on radio, would it?
So, Ian, given that we've had another finely scripted and finely rehearsed... an essential few moments of broadcasting dialogue. Who would you like to ask you those last two questions now, please?
You.
Me?
Yes.
Ian, wow.
Just to see if you can remember them.
Well, let's see now.
Well, I can't.
Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
Yes, I have, thank you.
And can we look forward to seeing you in the very near future, possibly in 7 days from now?
I do hope so, and I might bring along my lodger.
Hey. Oh, that could be fun.
Let me out! Let me out now!
Shut up!
Yeah.
Classic movie, Limahl, Never Ending Story. I wonder if anybody's actually seen it in the studio. Have you seen Never Ending Story, Emily?
I haven't, I can't say I have.
Rory, Never Ending Story?
I can't say that I have.
No. Kira, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Never Ending Story?
No.
Frozen 2?
Yes, brilliant. Yeah. Absolutely loved it. Yeah.
We did say when Richard was doing his spiel earlier.
I know,
that
I missed
you were
it.
In,
I was
you're
so
still in
upset.
Recovery. Still in recovery from Frozen 2.
It was.
So, no major spoilers, but is it something Emily's likely to enjoy when she heads back to?
I would say so, to be fair. I honestly think it's like the best Disney sequel they've ever done. I would go ahead and say that.
It's better than the first one, is that? Is that a reach?
In a way, in different elements, yeah. Like animation-wise, yes, definitely. Song-wise, no.
Really?
Oh. I think the first Frozen, it's more catchy songs. But this one, it's more like heartwarming ones that tugs at your heartstrings.
Kira, let it go. In a few moments from now, the news from the Sky News Centre, and then we're off to actually speak to our comedian Hal Cruttendon about Christmas challenges and various other items as well from that point of view. Meanwhile, the life continues on the Siren Radio, Lincoln's first community radio station, as we head to the news from the Sky News Centre, which, I don't know, I'd say 20 seconds or so, and then we'll press that button. Well, I mean, to be precise, obviously, maybe actually 15 seconds, or we can just fill a reminder that William Sitwell will hopefully be with us, cybersecurity and more in the second hour of the programme, and this evening, of course... Microphones go live. Where's the actual sort of scenario here? Highs of 9 degrees centigrade, lows of 1 degree centigrade, a day of light rain and a moderate breeze. I thank you. Then again, it would seem that people in Sheffield would much rather say goodbye to Christmas. If it's that stressful, honestly, just let it go. That's the important thing. So, survey by 2,000 people, which suggests that the December season is more stressful than birthdays and Halloween. Who can we actually bring on board to hopefully address this issue? Well, obviously, the ace comedian, Hal Cruttendon. How are you, Hal?
I'm very well. How are you?
Well, not too stressed, unless, of course, I was living in Sheffield or London or Oxford, really. I mean, this research by Vago, not good, is it, really? Particularly if you're travelling over the season.
Well, do you know what, though? It isn't good, but the thing is, I'm thinking I'm not surprised. I'm quite a miserable humbug, but I'm thinking, what was it, 38% of say that spending Christmas with family is stressful. Who are the weird 62% that don't find that stressful? I'm thinking that I am the worst thing. My wife, but this is absolutely true, puts humbugs in my presence to basically have a thing go, you are a humbug at Christmas. So yeah, I am the worst. But no, I think it is very interesting, but I think it's good that people are owning up to this. Only up to the fact that Christmas is very stressful.
Well, we were talking earlier with Ian Lennox, one of our Tyneside correspondents, who maintained the only reason Newcastle are the third most laid-back areas because most of them are actually alcohol-imbibed and just laying back, so they're completely sort of out of it from that point of view. I thought so. I thought, and Ian coming from Newcastle as well, but I'm just reiterating that whole side of things. Still, then, yeah. Bristol, of course, and York coming in terms of the most laid back aspects too. I mean, how can we stay positive, Hal? And I mean, is it a case of we need to obviously get or book Hal Cruttendon to entertain the family, and then all will be well with the world?
Well, yes, exactly. But no, I suppose it's that thing of keeping space from each other, isn't it? That's the problem, is that you're forced into situations where you're spending lots of time with the family, you've got everybody over, and you have to kind of keep creating space. Do day trips, get away, don't be in one house for all that time. I think that's the thing, is you know, keep a... I mean, obviously, it's... And also maybe, I don't know, maybe admit to yourself that it is quite stressful. When you get together with your family... I mean, I have an older sister that I spend quite a lot of time, you know, I'll see for Christmas and stuff, but she's still always my older sister. Just admit that to yourself. You're always going to be the little brother. She's always going to tell me things. I'm always going to go, yes, I agree. You know, you never quite lose your place in the family, and I think that's... I find this very refreshing, just the very idea that people are going, let's admit that it's really stressful, and that we all go, oh, thank God we've got through that. I think also it's that thing sort of having realistic expectations, but also making sure that you can, you know, you can get away. You can go and, you know, jump in your car for the day and go somewhere else, and don't feel like you have to be somewhere all the time, you know, in the house with people that you do. Maybe the truth is we need to also admit that we do find a lot of relatives quite stressful, and we get together with them at Christmas, like your parents or your siblings, and you sort of remind yourself how lovely it is you don't have to live with them anymore.
Okay, I mean, obviously you can choose your friends, you can't choose your family, the old maxim goes. Although I'm sure anybody who's got Abigail Cruttendon as their sister is obviously blessed and important from that point of view.
I am very close to my sister, but I do, I think it was my wife was reminding me of this, going, do you know what the problem is when you're together for a long time with your sister, you just revert to your childhood roles. Okay. And so she says, she tells me something, and I go, oh, yes, is that true? And my wife goes, no, I disagree. And Hal, you're siding with your sister again. So, yes, it's always all about family politics.
Hal, let's bring in our studio team here, and we'll sort of just briefly go through the process for that. Now, from the, I mean, Essex, being in Essex alone in Southend probably is very stressful, but from your own point of view, Emily, anything on what you've heard from Hal at this moment? Does it echo with your experience?
I think the lead up to Christmas, I'd say, is stressful, the buying the presents and everything like that. But on the actual day of Christmas, I don't find it stressful at all, but maybe that's because I don't do much. I just get to sit back and watch.
So there's one solution, Hal. Simply don't do anything at all.
I think that's the thing. I think that's what I miss from being a child, is doing nothing at all. And then when you become an adult, people go, do that, and if you don't do it, you're made to feel guilty. Yeah. So that's fine if you don't have a guilt about doing nothing.
And I suppose at the end of the day, you're a final year student reading English at University of Lincoln. Why would you do anything? You
know? Exactly. I do. Ouch.
made you feel really bad.
I do help out with Mum with serving up the dinner and stuff, but 9 times out of 10 I try to stay out of the kitchen because I think
conflict.
Yeah,
potential conflict.
I stay out of there.
Okay, let's.
Can I admit, by the way, I'm completely the same. That my wife does always cook the Christmas dinner if we're doing it. And I just feel guilty because I'm just not a good enough cook. So I do try. If you do the washing, you know, make sure the washing up's done.
Yeah.
Do the dishwasher. It's not that hard.
I wrap the presents as well. I think that helps Mum out. Obviously not my own presents, but I wrap the presents for the family. So that helps out, I suppose, yeah.
Okay, Rory, from a male perspective in Bedfordshire, is it a case of no? I'm like, it's like a crack team in the McGowan household. We effectively sort of, you know, everything is drilled within an inch of perfection.
No, I have to agree with Emily and say that it's really the present buying that kind of gets me at Christmas. Because when you're thinking about birthdays, they come at one at a time. You've only got to get one thing, and that's it.
Yeah.
When it comes to Christmas, you're now thinking about a whole host of people who all may want different things, and you don't know if they've got something already or if they don't.
Give them thoughts.
Is can that... I also say, particularly hard for men, because I think we're naturally incredibly thoughtless. So it's really hard for us to concentrate and think about other people.
Huge
sexist generalisation. My wife, I promise you this too, she does this every year. My wife has said to me, oh, I'm so excited, I've got you the perfect present. And she's already said that to me. I've got the perfect present for you. And I'm just sitting there going, what would you like?
Gift
you
know, token? Gift voucher?
No. Terrible. Exactly.
Socks, perhaps? No. Kira.
Okay, I do think it's the presents, but also I think it depends who's hosting the Christmas day, because if it's my mum and dad, it's really stressful because they're always telling me to do things. I don't even know how to cook a chicken and do all this other stuff, and I'm just like there. But if it's, say, my auntie and uncle, my grandparents that are hosting it, it's fine. You just get to sit back and watch. And also, I think you've got to just not have expectations of anybody on Christmas Day.
So clearly the connection with the Kira Allsbrook household is get your uncle and aunts to actually do it. Are these the Scottish family people?
Yes.
So actually, if they argue, you just find it most amusing
anyway.
It is
really amusing, I'm not going
to
lie.
So I wanted to put this to you, Hal, actually. I mean, Kira finds apparently the thought of Scottish people when they argue quite hilarious, really. Is that anything you've introduced into your routines, to actually just have two Scottish people arguing fairly heavily?
The family I spend a lot of time with is my wife's family. They're Northern Irish, and I find this similar to the Scots. I just get scared when they get angry. I'm very impressed that you find it funny. I assume that makes them even angrier.
Yes, it does. I've got to basically sometimes when my mum and my nana has been arguing, basically I'll just start giggling, and then they'll both glare at me, and then my mum would just. Well, I say politely in quotation marks, tell me to leave the room.
But you don't think it's like, you and your funny Scottish.
Yeah. Never say that. You'll get slapped.
Yeah, I can see that. And in terms of being a taxi for family and friends, obviously going back to this whole notion of Vago and lines from that point of view, 2 in 5 say that traffic is the worst thing about travelling during the festive season. Maybe we should all just stay home, really.
Oh, well, I mean, my daughters are 17 and 19, and I really, really need them to pass their tests because they're being quite. I don't want to be horrible about them. But actually, they're not listening. They're rubbish. They've not learned to drive. And that thing of, I'm a taxi year round, but especially at Christmas when they're out to see friends off. And it is that thing, isn't it, where I'm not saying I have an alcohol problem, but you can't drink because they're going, oh, could you pick me up at 11:30? And you're like, I just want to sit and have a few beers. So it is horrific, yes. It's best to get your kids to pass their test.
That makes perfect sense. And of course, the ultimate perfect Christmas present really has to be tickets for any Hal Cruttenton gig. That's the key thing from that point of view. So access details on that and sort the thing through. Where can people go for further information about Vago, though, Hal? Where's the best place you'd point them?
Oh, vago.com /winter, I think I'll be doing a podcast as well on this, you know, how to get through Christmas. So that's where you get
hire a couple of Scottish actors to argue amongst themselves, thereby creating great hilarity.
Well, they've got these Vago thing that I think is great is that they have a thing where they're talking about you can get this short term insurance. So basically, you can just if you haven't got car insurance on a car, but you can drive, you can just drive away from the horrible relatives that you're with. I mean, it's been fantastic. Anyway,
do you realise, Hal? I've just been looking at the 2019 tour of Your Good Self, and you were last in Lincoln on the 9th of February. That's far too long a period of time.
No, this is... I was, well, when was I last there?
No,
I was last
9th of February, we have.
Yeah, 9th of February. Yes. I know. I've got to create the new show now. Basically, I'm my tour's just finished. I've just been touring all over the country, and I'm going to be doing I'll be doing my next one 2021, but I'll be all over the place in various gigs.
In which case the next perfect Christmas present has to be Tough Lovey. Are D.V. Hal Cruttendon live.
Yes, exactly. While I'm plugging nextup.com. I've done a video for Nextup, which if you say quick enough sounds like Netflix.
Nice. So we did that. Yeah, next up Netflix. Marvellous. Next up, genius. Hal, two final little lines for your good self. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today? Has it been okay for you?
Has it been okay for me? I've loved it.
This is good. So can we?
It's early in the morning. It's great.
Can we look forward to featuring you again in the very near future? Will you come back?
Always, always.
A round of applause for Hal Cruttendon, please. And yes, I'm sure we can actually, because comedians, a bit like rock star musicians, etc., really quite challenging at this time of day. As indeed Kira would enhance, because she missed the first hour because she just set her alarm on snooze. But whatever.
Sorry.
Well, she's a student, isn't she?
This is true.
Yes, there should be still a student.
That's it. Astoundingly,
emails are not carbon neutral. I know, it's challenging. A new survey of 3,000 British folk released today by OVO Energy has revealed that the UK sends 64 million unnecessary emails every day with a yearly carbon footprint of 23,475 tons. Well, we just really need to actually address this in so many ways. So who better than Professor at Lancaster University, the wonderful Mike Berners-Lee. How are you, Mike?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. Your research, of course, carbon metrics and sustainable food systems. And I love your text, There Is No Planet B and How Bad Are Bananas? Just because the name is just wonderful, great for that point of view. And Sarah Booth. Welcome, Sarah, of course, Director of OVO Energy, I presume, basically, or Director of Sustainability. Is that correct?
I'm Director of Brand and Communications.
Brand and Communications. Excellent. Okay. Mike, I've been sharing this with some of my own students here at the University of Lincoln, and they were shocked because obviously in a there's a lot of email traffic that goes through in all sorts of ways from that point of view, and it's really caught a lot of people on the hop, this. I mean, were you surprised by the amount that's actually sort of spent out there? I mean, if we can actually reduce it, apparently it'd be the equivalent to taking 3,334 diesel cars off the road.
It doesn't surprise me, but if you look at the carbon footprint of our emails as a proportion of all of our total carbon footprint, actually it turns out to be pretty tiny. But it's a brilliant illustration of the fact that if we can just cut the junk out of our lives, we can not only shave off the carbon, but we can also make our lives better while we're at it. And it just illustrates the point that the low carbon world can be a better world than the high carbon world. Because most of us, surely all of us, live in a world in which we're swamped out with email. And if we could just reduce it to only the quality emails that we actually need to receive, then our lives would be better, wouldn't it?
I think it's a fair point to actually say. I mean, Sarah, I sort of left the office last night around about 4:30, 5 o'clock this morning in at 7 a.m. I got 126 emails to actually work through, many of which are kind of fairly standard lines of students wanting to book appointments, various other bits and pieces and so on. Is it a case where we kind of need to be more rigorous and almost undergo a digital detox to actually clarify how essential emails actually are?
I don't know if a digital detox is necessarily what we need to do, but I think what's really helpful is to just pause as you send an email and think, is that one necessary? For example, is that person sitting right beside me, and can I say thank you very much instead of sending a thanks on an email? We know that a personal thank you is nicer than a digital one. Or do all those people need to be CC'd in that email? I think those kinds of questions are really important questions, and that has two effects. One, it reduces our carbon footprint a little bit, but the second is that we don't then all have to come in to 120 emails every morning, which makes everybody's lives a bit more efficient and a bit nicer.
It's an interesting one. And does the same thing, similar sort of thing, hold, Mike, for text and other messages, or indeed if you're using social networking, is it the same sort of blight that we're faced with?
Yeah, it's exactly the same principle. And, you know, if we can just reduce the volume of the communication, then we are improving all of our abilities to actually spend time looking at the quality stuff. And one of the things that we all need to get better at is, there's so much information out there that we all need all the help we can get with discerning which are the bits that are important, which are the bits that actually are deserving of our attention.
In terms of the top 10 most unnecessary emails, and I was interested to see that LOL obviously came in at number 10, and number one, literally, thank you. Now, it's been suggested that this is just due to etiquette, shall we say, and politeness and so on. Is it a case of we need to just sort of think a little bit about that? Or as you said, effectively, Sarah, you know, if you're literally sitting in the same sort of region as a colleague who sends you the email, maybe you just need to say, thank you, that's great.
Yeah, I think that's the case. We actually went and had a chat with Debrett's about this because we were a bit worried about asking people to say thank you less. Mm. But they thought that actually an acknowledgement email is good practice, but clogging up someone's inbox with unnecessary stuff is actually not very polite at all. So it was quite funny to have that conversation with them about what happens when the climate emergency hits etiquette, hits British etiquette, and what should we do about that, which was quite nice. But they thought, it's really about, if the thank you is really important and that person's not there and they've done something really wonderful for you, of course you must say thank you. But if someone is sitting over the room, than say thank you in person. It's much nicer.
Mike, a few years ago, it was very popular, at least it seemed to be the vogue, when emails were sent to actually sort of request receipts to actually prove that the email had been read, etc. Does that also magnify the issue?
Well, it does, but you know what? It is about judgment, because sometimes it's actually, sometimes it is useful to let somebody know that you've received and acknowledged an email, and sometimes a simple thanks, does have value, but sometimes it doesn't. So it's just, as Sarah says, it's about pausing before pressing the send button. And, you know, email is just one form of junk in our lives. But the wider message here is that, you know, we all have all kinds of junk in our lives. This is also about pausing before actually going and buying that thing that you maybe don't really need and is just going to clutter the place up. Because, you know, all the material things that we buy, in a similar way to the emails that we send, you know, have a footprint, actually a bigger footprint than emails. And, you know, in the low carbon world, we can make our lives better by cutting out that kind of junk too.
And e-cards, as we approach the festive and holiday season, e-cards preferable to snail mail cards and physical cards, or is that just a no-brainer?
Well, they do have a lower carbon footprint, but, you know, all these things are about bang for buck. So if you're wondering whether to send your granny a Christmas card that she's going to really, really appreciate, then the answer is probably that little bit of carbon is absolutely worth it. But if you're asking the question about whether it's worth adding another 5,000 names to your corporate Christmas card list, then the answer could be no.
And that's why you produce the carbon footprint of everything, Mike. Fantastic stuff on that basis. Sarah, where would you point people in the direction of, apart from obviously from Mike's excellent book, to find out further details about that, and obviously what OVO are doing in betwixt times for this?
Yeah, of course. So you can go to the OVO Energy website to find out more about zero carbon living. And you can find things on there like what we've created for this particular idea, which is a little carbon capper, which is a little Chrome plugin that you can put on your emails. And if you are sending one that's less than 5 words, it'll just give you a little prompt and say, do you definitely want to send that? We've also created a little email signature that you can pop at the bottom of your email that sort of acts as a thanks in advance. So when you're having a conversation with someone, it just says, this is a thanks in advance. So if you don't hear from me later, it's not because of you. It's because every email has a little impact.
Or maybe I've ceased to be and downloaded my intelligence into another computer artificial intelligence system somewhere. maybe that's for the end of the 21st century. For the moment, though, Professor Mike Berners-Lee from Lancaster University and Sarah Bruth from OVO, many, many thanks indeed. Take care now. Yes, the old notion of downloading intelligence, corporate carbon neutral scenario, etc. William Sitwell, it's so different from the home life of our own dear Queen, I presume.
Yes,
exactly. Let's deal with a fairly sombre piece to start off with, because obviously not only did we lose Clive James and Jonathan Miller yesterday, but also Gary Rhodes passed on, etc. And clearly with your own wonderful sort of background in terms of culinary matters and issues, etc., I'm sure you must have worked with Gary on several occasions.
I've never worked with him, actually. I didn't appear on any shows, but I did meet him, I think, at a book launch or two. And he was always very, very charming. He was a very straight guy, very decent man. He was a very exacting, precise chef. He was a perfectionist, which is a word that does get banded around a lot, but he really was a perfectionist. Mm. And, he was one of the first chefs to go on TV, really, wearing a chef's jacket, you know, after people like Keith Floyd, who were sort of on television in their civvies, so to speak. And he came to the public's knowledge with people like Anthony Worrell Thompson and Ainsley Harriott in those things like Ready, Steady, Cook and so on. And then, of course, he got his own shows. But funnily enough, I was reviewing a restaurant called The Castle in Taunton just a few weeks ago, and that's where Gary Rhodes, at the tender age of 26, won his first Michelin star. He was a South London boy. He took his craft very seriously. But I think one interesting thing about him is that he took his training of the methodology and the technique of French gastronomy and brought that to bear with producing some of the great English classics. He was a great proponent of English puddings and the like. But he did get some flack in the 90s, if you remember, when he became the face of Tate and Lyle, and people thought that actually a chef shouldn't be promoting sugar in that way. And then I think a lot of people were just shocked and then surprised about Gary yesterday, because they also thought, well, hang on, where has he been? We haven't heard from him. And actually, in 2007, he upsticks and went to Dubai But what I think one has to admire is that there are a lot of chefs, and we know who they are. They go to Dubai, they slap their name on a hotel restaurant, they get paid a huge consultancy fee, and then they go somewhere else. Gary Rhodes moved out there, moved his family out there, and he lived out there. And there's a lot of young chefs out there who I know have worked with him and like the fact that he is there among them. You know, he was there, he worked with them. And,
excellent. Well, I say much, Mr. I think that's an excellent tribute to William, and obviously his impact will resonate in all sorts of other wonderful ways. Rory, any questions you'd like to put to the awesomeness that is William Sitwell?
Sure, that was...
You see, caught on the hop there, William. You know, he's all set and ready to go, but he's just
come on, I was reading about Gary Rhodes, that's all, the stuff that he's done.
Did he impact your life, Rory, or is it because I mean, clearly, when as William just said, at the height of his routine, just before he actually went into the sugar scenario, sugar is the new nicotine. That's our catchphrase. Beware. In terms of that system, you would not have been born.
I would not have.
No. Did you get the feeling it's early in the morning, Rory? You know, maybe it's just a case of working through the process.
Yeah.
Emily, thoughts from yourself.
In regards to William Sitwell, I do have one question for you. Coming up to Christmas, what would you say in regards to cooking for Christmas, baking, etc., is the best thing to cook when at home?
What would you cook at home?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about, Christmas lunch, I mean, I think it's always good to have a Christmas cake.
Mm.
I mean, I don't like marzipan, and I tend to avoid fruits, cakes, if I can, unless I'm very, very cold and I've just fallen into a river or something and I need some cake and whiskey.
Mm.
Otherwise, I tend to avoid it. But it's always good to have a Christmas cake. I think you should make a Yule log.
Oh,
everyone likes a Yule log. Mm. You know, a nice chocolate Swiss roll.
Mm.
You might have missed syrup Sunday, but it's still time to make a Christmas pudding.
Do you find it stressful at Christmas cooking? Because we had the conversation earlier about Christmas and how stressful it can become in the kitchen.
Sheffield in particular is the place that's notorious in the United Kingdom for being the most stressful at Christmas.
Right. Well, I tell you, I've got about 18 people, I think, on set this year. And we sent an email out, my wife and I, last night to everyone, delegating a few jobs of things that we wanted people to buy.
We were just losing that sort of connection. We got the dedicated to things and jobs that you wanted people to actually buy and purchase for you, William.
I'll tell you why you should.
We're losing him.
Oh,
we're losing him again. Oh, no, just as that critical advice is coming through. Are you still there, William?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Yes.
Do you know where I am?
Where are you, William?
I'm in Lincolnshire.
No.
Yeah, I just crossed to the border. I'm on my way to a sprout farm.
Hey.
Oh.
Wonderful.
Oh.
Or as we like to refer to them, flatulence bombs. You know where you are with
exactly.
A decent sprout and all the time, for Christmas. Wonderful. A sprout farm. Is the Telegraph column taking a whole new angle now? Are there sprout farm restaurants that we can look forward to?
Well, I'll tell you, I've got this new monthly travel column I'll be doing for the Telegraph, and I thought, what more glamorous way of beginning by going to a sprout farm in Lincolnshire?
I'm sold.
I like to keep it real.
Absolutely. This is ideal. In fact, I almost think that's a location report we must actually put into the schedule for 2020. Forget our trips to London and indeed magical shows in Newark. You know, we'll move on to a whole new world. Kira, any questions for William?
Sprout farm sounds rather interesting. So, William, why are you exactly going to a sprout farm?
So that I can learn about sprouts, so I can try and hopefully spread the sprout love.
Are there different types of sprouts?
Speak to me in 2 hours. But you see, one of the things, what I was saying is delegate the task. And if you've got a few teenagers, get them to sit down and take the outer leaves off the sprouts and chop the tops off and put that little cross in. You know, make sure everyone's got a job, and actually people who might think it's a pain actually then find themselves sitting around the kitchen chatting with their granny as they do the prep. So I think don't be stressed. Use anyone who's coming as your workforce. Enslave them.
Nice.
And give them drinks or whatever it is they want, whatever they need.
Rory, is that inspiration striking?
Yes, my redemption for stuttering earlier. Do the people that you have round, William, for Christmas dinner ever think that you're always judging their cooking?
Mm.
Sorry, to say that again, I've just arrived in Calvert, rather enough.
Oh, sorry. Do the people you have round for Christmas dinner ever worry about you judging their cooking?
Mm. I mean, is it?
Well, people often say this. You know, I'm terrified if you're going to come round and you're going to start judging me. If they pay me, I'll judge them. Otherwise,
nice. Oh, see what you see. That's what it's all about. Fantastic, William. It's been fantastic. You have arrived, which is great stuff. Can we look forward next week to a Sprout special with your good self?
We can talk about whatever you like.
Well, I think Sprouts really should be coming. We'll be into Advent then, so we'll need to obviously have the Sprout Advent calendar and address various other sort of issues with respect to that. And Kira could obviously find out.
And perhaps you can explain the geological history of why the area around me is so flat.
Do you know, I think we will. I think it's all to do with the Ice Age, glaciers and various other sort of strange things that occurred. But, you know, what's a few million years between friends? That's what I often say. You know, keep us together. A round of applause for William Sitwell, please. Yay! And happy Sprout Farm Day, William, for Thanksgiving. You couldn't be in a better place.
Thank you.
Put on my blue suede shoes and I boarded the plane. Touchdown in the land of the Delta Blues, in the middle of the pouring rain. WC Handy, won't you look down over me? Yeah, I got a first class ticket, but I'm as blue as a boy can be. Then I'm walking in Memphis, just walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis, but do I really feel the way I feel? Saw the ghost of Elvis on Union Avenue. Followed him up to the gates of Graceland, and I watched him walk right through. Now security, they did not see him. They just hovered round his tomb. But there's a pretty little thing waiting for the king down in the jungle room. When I was walking in Memphis, I was walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis. Catfish on the table. They've got gospel in the air. Reverend Green, be glad to see you when you haven't got a prayer. But boy, you got a prayer in Memphis. Piano every Friday at the Hollywood, and they brought me down to see her, and they asked me if I would do a little number, and I sang with all my might. She said, tell me, are you a Christian child? And I said, ma'am, I am. Tonight, walking in Memphis, wow. Walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis. But do I really feel the way I feel? Walking in Memphis. I was walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis. Suede shoes and I boarded the plane. Touchdown in the land of the Delta Blues, in the middle of the pouring rain. touchdown in the land of the Delta Blues. In the middle of the pouring rain.
Well, it's over a year since Parliament's National Security Strategy Report revealed that there were issues with respect to cybersecurity, and yet cybersecurity training opportunities still aren't a priority. We know there might be something else that they're concerned with at present, beginning with elections and so on. But at the same time, a deepening talent gap in cybersecurity has the potential to cause irreparable damage to UK businesses. Now, to address this, we're delighted to welcome two fine folk. First of all, the CTO at Red Seal, the wonderful Dr. Mike Lloyd. How are you, Mike?
Very good. Good to be here this morning.
Very good. And we've also got the head of Department Information Security at Royal Holloway, University of London. That's Professor Peter Komisarchuk. How are you, Peter?
Hi.
Mike, if we can come to you first, this particular report doesn't really make pleasant reading, does it, really, in terms of where we could be heading in terms of the research and the skills gap that's present?
Yeah, I'm afraid talking to security professionals can be a grim business. But when we surveyed organizations, we found no less than 7 out of 8 of the companies we spoke to reported they did indeed have difficulty hiring enough cybersecurity talent. We unfortunately worldwide appear to have drained the talent pool. There aren't enough skilled people out there anymore. And this creates a big problem for online safety, right? We all live more of our lives online these days. And so if there aren't enough cybersecurity professionals, that's a problem for us. Although, on the bright side, this is also a career opportunity for those who have an interest in this area.
Yes, it's interesting to see that the average annual salary is $72,500, which is pretty much at the top range of most principal lecturers and various other ways, Peter. So from that point of view, let's talk about higher education. So I'm obviously underfunded, understaffed, stressed in all sorts of ways. But is it a case of we're still not really getting that balance right between dealing with the cybersecurity skills gap? Should we be more concerned with training as opposed to education, or is it a case of, well, we need to do both?
Indeed, it's a matter of both, because, of course, you could have the kids coming through school being pipelined into apprenticeships. These are level 4, 5, and 6 apprenticeships, so they could be foundation degrees and full degrees, typically over a part-time 4-year degree program. Or we can have full-time education opportunities at typically a lot of universities in the UK. And in terms of that, we have a rather fixed capacity because, of course, we have fixed lecture theatres, we have laboratories, and we have a certain amount of staff. So within the whole system, we have an upper bound, I think, in terms of the number of people we can actually get through the door and given these types of skills and knowledge.
So returning back to Mike again, in terms of this growing cyber skills gap, is it a case of people just aren't interested, they like to use their Facebook applications, they like to actually deal with the fruits of an online society, but fundamentally they don't really want to look about the security side of things?
Yeah, it's not a natural mindset for most people. You know, the security way of thinking is a little bit perverse. You have to think about how you can break things, not how you can construct things. And most people aren't naturally inclined to think that way. And, you know, we don't expect everybody to be a security expert, but we do need more troops for the cyber wars that we're involved in. As you say, everybody's lives is touched now by social media, by online banking, so many different ways that we've moved our world online. And unfortunately, these new infrastructures that we use are fragile. And so we have this burgeoning attack surface and a need to be able to figure out how to block all the ways in. You know, if you imagine ants trying to get into your kitchen, you know, no matter how many pathways you block, they always seem to find another one. And this is the nature of the online infrastructure we've got. And so we really have some work to do to improve this area. And we're finding that we can't produce skilled professionals quickly enough to solve this problem.
And that is certainly something, I suppose, in terms of the metaphor, that the notion of, I think, artificial intelligence back in the day, Peter, was to actually try and replicate the human mind with fuzzy logic and various other things. We now seem to have gone on to the hive mind and the way in which insects tend to work. Peter, have you noticed that there is a change in the kind of profile of students actually applying to your own particular course at Royal Holloway over the past 5 years or so?
Oh, indeed. In terms of the master's degree, we have many more part-time students and students looking to change careers. So they're in their 30s and 40s. They may be working in IT and want to change into cyber, or they may be from a business background or psychology or whatever, and again, they want to move into that cyberspace because the range of careers is actually quite large. We have at one end the softer end of cybersecurity, which is around awareness and training and so forth, right through to the other end where we have deep dark techies doing AI and cryptography.
And again, clearly, in terms of, we mentioned the election coming through, there are lots of concerns about where foreign governments, foreign agencies may or may not be looking to interfere, and so on and so forth. Mike, in terms of this, the next stage in development, there is, of course, the line which says, well, don't worry, Skynet is going to take over. It'll be run by computers because Singularity is just 5 years around the corner anyway.
Yeah, you hear a lot of people who aren't involved in the field who think this way. But I think within the security business, we've begun to realize that Skynet is, in fact, not right around the corner. I specialize in machine reasoning, and I try to get machines to reason about the outside world. And when you really work in this area, you realize that computers are inexhaustible but quite stupid. We've proven that we can make machines very, very good.
You say that my Alexa is stupid. I'm outraged by that in terms of things.
Don't get me started on the security risk of having an always-on microphone.
Precisely, yes.
But computers are very good at chess, but they're not very good at poker. Yeah. And unfortunately, our online world is a lot more like poker. We're up against adversaries with complex economic or state politics motivation, and the computers just don't understand that. They're very good at checking details, and so we find the right answer is human-computer teams, and that's why technologists such as myself works with somebody like the professor with students, because we want to show students that it can actually be quite exciting to work with machines as assistants, because they are so good at checking the details, but we still need a human for the strategy. Computers for tactics, humans for strategy seems to be their way forward.
Peter, I'm noticing obviously more and more of my students, both in the areas of journalism and the areas of English and so on, are actually using obviously their own particular tech-savvy devices, etc. More and more courses have, by necessity, obviously, needs to have an online-facing present, etc. If somebody's actually, shall we say, a humanities undergraduate present, would you say it's a huge leap to actually switch to cybersecurity, or would you say that in terms of career pathways, career changes, etc., maybe it could be something that they might like to consider?
Oh, definitely they should be considering that, because a lot of companies are actually taking social scientists and so forth and actually training them to be coders and cybersecurity analysts and so forth. So they shouldn't be frightened of that, as long as they like technology, they have the aptitude to reason, to solve problems, they have an inquiring mind, and they have soft skills, which typically social scientists tend to have. Mm-hmm. These are great things for the workplace. They can fit into the organization, and they can learn a lot of the technical aspects on the job.
And Mike, in terms of people wishing to find out cybersecurity skills and the UK's critical national infrastructure, where would you point them to go to actually access the report?
Yeah, it was certainly the study that we did is available at redseal.net. If you hit our website, there's a button there for digital resilience. There are also some UK government resources. Professor?
Oh, indeed. For example, in terms of certified degrees, the NCSC has certified a range of degrees at undergraduate and postgraduate level in the UK. And so if you search for NCSC certified degrees in cybersecurity, you should find that. Also, for those in the younger age range from 11 to 18 or 13 to 18, there are activities that are online and also in summer schools funded by the government. So we have Cyber Defenders and Cyber First courses, which can be done online and over the summer in residential courses at universities.
I know also from Royal Holloway College, Royal Holloway University of London, one of our associates, Professor Fiona Moore, wrote the quintessential book on Battlestar Galactica a few years ago. So interesting in terms of cyberspace and various other factors at this stage. But for the moment, Dr. Mike Lloyd, CTO at Red Seal, and of course, Professor Peter Komisarchuk, Head of Department of Information Security at Royal Holloway University of London. Many thanks indeed, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Watch your stare. Don't look at
Which, of course, computer can do. Crash, that is. The Primitives and the aforementioned Crash on Siren Radio. As we approach the closure of another Midweek Drive Morning Edition, the last ever Midweek Drive Morning Edition for November 2019. Don't worry, there'll be one for December. And several, actually, more. Anyway, this has been a programme which has taken us from Gibraltar and Gabriella Peralta, Richard Fitzwilliams, of course, in London. Will you go and see Le Mans? Will you go and see the Aeronauts? Will you just actually chill out and see Frozen 2 again? Ian Lennox, of course, his Tyneside thoughts. Hal Cruttendon gave us some responses to dealing with festive stress. Mike Berners-Lee, together with Sarah Booth, told us, don't send that email, you've been practicing on the world's carbon footprint. Don't just send the emails. Think before you send it. And William Sitwell, of course, Sprouts, and a tribute to Gary Rhodes, finally wrapped up with Mike Lloyd and Peter Komitsarchuk from Royal Holloway College London with cyber security. And in the studio, we've had Rory McGowan and Emily Boston and Kira Alsbrook. And at 7 o'clock this evening, we've got Sound and Country Vision. And Emily, will you be back with us next week?
Yes.
And Rory, will you be around next week?
Absolutely.
Yes. And Kira?
Yeah.
Yes, and Kira, myself, possibly Emma Street, if she ever turns up.
Yes.
Who knows? Might be heading off to do maybe a Locos report, maybe an evening of magic with David Fox in Newark later on this evening. So that's all to come. Don't forget, of course, this weekend it is the Lincoln Food and Gift Festival and Fair, and a couple of Midweek Drivettes, myself, will be heading off to do a press preview night tomorrow. I think you're on that, let's
yes,
say.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, something like that. That's very good. Emily, one of these days we'll get that together. But I just, you know, we're finding out where you're coming from, etc. You're going to dive into this.
That's fine,
sort of
eventually.
Sequence. Yeah, exactly. Before too long, it will happen. So that's pretty much it. Shall we go with, I'll give you a choice. We can either use the line from our cybersecurity people, computers for tactics, humans for strategy. Could be a slogan.
That's too long for me at the moment.
It's too long. So it is going to be Happy Thanksgiving Day, I suppose, for Americans, at least, from that point of view, where they give thanks for having sort of departed from the British world, etc. Okay, one, two, three.
Happy Thanksgiving Day!